You are now listening to The Griot's Black Podcast Network, Black Culture Amplified.
Hello, I'm Maisha Kai, host of The Griot's Writing Black Podcast. In West African tradition, to be a griot is to be a storyteller, one who carries and communicates the experiences and legacies of a people. As The Griot's lifestyle editor, I've always been fascinated by how we tell our stories. That's why we launched Writing Black, to explore the myriad ways Black writers craft stories and communicate our experiences. Thank you for joining us. Here's an excerpt from this week's guest. Uzochi sat on an azure couch, exhaling, continuing to zone in on the energy at his center, feeling it fill his heart, head, and limbs. For more than an hour, he'd been planted there, refusing to rise until his body was settled. Staring at the sofa's fabric, its color reminding him of the strange blue light that had continued to reappear in his line of sight since he'd left the fight near school. By the time he'd made it home to Kip's Bay, he was shaking. He'd gone straight up to his apartment, unable to do anything but sit and breathe. And he's been in a lot of things. I'm talking Juice, loving basketball, the wood, ER. You may have even seen him most recently on Power, Raising Kanan. That's right. It is the one and only. Omar Epps is with us this week. Omar, thank you so much for being on Writing Black. This is so exciting to me. How are
you? Thank you for having me. I'm good. Thank you for having me.
Oh my God, I'm so tickled by this. Like, you know, I speak for several more than one generation of women to say that this is a moment in time for us. So don't worry, I will not let that be the crux of our discussion today. But we created this podcast because we really wanted to talk about the intersection of identity and craft and language and how we use language. And obviously, as both an actor and an author, you have a unique perspective on how we use language. So I'm really excited to talk to you about that. but also, you know, I don't think a lot of people know you're an author. So you had a book out, Fatherless to Fatherhood.
Yeah, From Fatherless to Fatherhood.
Which was a really intimate memoir about your experiences. I think a really relatable one to a lot of people. Yeah. So I do want to talk about that. And also you have an upcoming book, which brings you into another genre. You're delving into the world of like Afrofuturism and a little bit of YA, I believe, with Nubia, The Awakening. How did this project come to you? Like, how did this, I mean, was this always an interest of yours, or was it something that has developed recently?
Well, to be quite honest with you, I mean, I'm a fan of all genres of just art, period, in all formats. And you connect where, you know, or when and where you connect. And to be quite honest, the germination of the idea is something that I've had in my head for like over a decade now. And when I went on that journey from my memoir, From Fatherless to Fatherhood, when I was promoting it, it was just what blew me away was like how many people actually still read books, because we're in like this digital age. And, you know, I come from the mother, I'm the son of an educator. And so I read a lot when I was young. Mm-hmm. And so in the back of my mind, I was wondering like, man, I wonder if kids still like avidly read books. And so we were at this book convention at the Jacob Javits Center. There were like hundreds of kids lined up, you know, on this one line. And I was like, well, what's that for? And they were like, oh, that's a young adult sci-fi. I forget the author's name, forgive me, but they're like huge in the space. And the people I was with were like explaining to me, like, you know, they're a rock star, these kids. And I was like blown away, like, wow, kids still read books. And so when I went to the hotel that night, it was the light bulb moment, you know, of Nubia, The Awakening. I, like I said, it'd been sitting in my head, and it was just something, a voice was tapping me on the shoulder, said, hey, it's time to unearth this and figure it out, because there is an audience for it. And they are rabid, they're dedicated, they're loyal. You know, I didn't know that, you know, in this particular format. So it was a 3.5-year journey to write the book. My co-author is Clarence A. Haynes, who's a rock star himself. And with Penguin Random House, Delacorte, you know, it's just been an amazing experience so far because people really believe in the project and the vision. And, you know, the topics that sort of are the underbelly of the book. People are really, the advanced reads, the response has been phenomenal. Because I've really tried to weave, it's this sort of magical, there's that, you know, fantastical element, but it's really rooted in some deep truths and deep questions mm-hmm. about, you know, why we are how we are, mm-hmm. you know. Mm-hmm. To your point earlier, when you talk about the use of words and things of that nature, and I tried to take that sort of nugget and really unpack it and peel back the layers of the onion, if you will.
Yeah, I mean, I think exactly what you just said is exactly why we created this podcast. Like, you know, when you talk about bringing identity to the fore, and we have seen this huge surge in the YA market in, I would say, the last 5 to 10 years. But I totally agree with you. I think it's what we've learned thus far from these narratives, it's impossible, obviously, to talk about the future without some context of the past. And mm-hmm. I think that's what makes fantastical literature from our demographic that much more intriguing, frankly.
Right.
You know,
right. I think that's a great thought. And, you know, as Black and brown people, if you will, you know, it's a really interesting thing in terms of us in general, but specifically the youth demographic, the teen demographic, because as we grow and evolve through life, we realize that we have to unlearn skewed narratives that we were just taught in school. You know, Christopher Columbus discovered America and all, you know, and one after the other, which is all not true. And if you don't seek out the real information, the truth of the information, then you'll just go off for someone else's narrative that's actually untrue. And so I find that specifically in our communities, because especially when you go abroad, and you travel across the world, it's like every other culture is learning the real truth.
Right.
You know, we're the ones that have it misconstrued, and it's not to a fault of our own.
Right.
So with a book like Nubia, The Awakening, I'm trying to tap into that in subtle ways, right? Kind of like, put the castor oil on top of some pancakes and then put some syrup on that, you know, you know, so it's still entertaining, but you know, after the reader, especially a young reader, reads the book, you know, they're going to walk away with some questions mm-hmm. about certain things in life. And I was intentful with writing it for a younger demographic because that's when the mind is still, I'm not even talking about development. It's just a sponge.
Yes,
it's just soaking
it's open,
in information.
It's pliable. I totally hear you. I used to teach that exactly. age group, so I get it.
Yeah. Totally. Yeah. So it's, you know, it's kind of like dropping some seeds in there. And also, you know, it correlates to a lot of what's, though the book takes place basically 100 years from now, a lot of the overarching themes, if you will, in the book, they correlate to certain things now, or at least that's how I try to execute it.
Yeah.
So that the message at the end that the reader gets is like, wow, this kind of, you know, feels like now.
Yeah. You know? I mean, we've seen that happen, you know. I mean, whether it's an author who's writing now, or, you know, we've seen this recently, like a lot of people got really interested in Octavia Butler for the first time in the last few years mm-hmm. because all of a sudden things that she was writing, like in her like parable trilogy, were all of a sudden so prescient and so relevant. And, you know, these are books I read in real time, you know, that I was like, oh my gosh, you're totally right. You know, I loved what you were saying about the YA audience and how pliable they are. Jason Reynolds, who, you know, incredible YA writer, has done tons of books. I remember asking him at one point, we had a conversation, I asked him like, so why, you know, why children's books, essentially, why YA books? He's like, well, you know, people always like kind of poo-poo this, like, you're somehow like copping out if you write for a children's audience. He's like, they're both the best and the hardest demographic to write for, you know, because you have to get it right. But also they're the best audience. Like, what better audience than one that, to your point, is so open and so fluid. And I don't want to say pliable, because I think to your point, like, I think that's more on the parents, right? You know, but in terms of what they're able to absorb and consider, I think is important.
And adjust.
Yes.
And adjust. The younger crowd, they adjust on the fly. They just deal with life as it comes, because they don't have the weight of so many responsibilities on their shoulders just yet. Because as those things come along, it can harden your mind, you know?
Right.
Because you got to punch that clock. I got to put food on the table, and you just sort of get stringent with the mind. Whereas, you know, a young person can, you know, they change their favorite color tomorrow, and it's okay. Especially this generation now, they're so interconnected. Mm-hmm. You know, I look at it, I look at that part of it as a gift, you know, the fact that if I was like 13, you know how when we were kids, they had like pen pals, and you just sort of write somebody randomly, and then they might write you back, or exchange programs, stuff like that. I think it's very, very powerful for this generation to now, I'm just using this as a ruse, but like, you know, they may watch something on the news, right? And it's like, this is happening in this place, but they may have a Twitter or Instagram friend that's actually boots on the ground in that place, and they're able to get in real time, no, this is actually what's going on. So it's hard to hide the information, and it's hard to misinform this generation. And I think that down the line, that's a massive gift, because it's gonna knock down these barriers that we have, whether it's ethnicity, socioeconomics, and or just the idea of tribalism, right? There's always gonna be that element of human life, right? You know, I'm from New York, I like the Yankees. Oh, you're from Philly, you like that we'll always have that part of it. But at least there's an innocence to that, because it's just competition, right? Mm-hmm. But in the minutia of actual life, you know, that's part of why I based the book out of New York as well. New York is sort of the other character, not biased because I was born and raised here, but strategically.
It's okay if you're biased. That's fine. If that's
no, but I'm not biased, because there's beautiful places. But
listen, I lived in New York for over 20 years. I'm biased, and I still think of it as well. Get it.
It's well. I'll say the old New York that I come from. It's totally different. This New York looks like Tokyo.
You
or something.
Are absolutely correct about that, sir. You are. Yes.
But there was. I only brought that up because there was an honesty to people back then that I think that was very pure.
Right.
And there were so many different cultures, and every culture had their little pocket. So, and then you all got to smash together like sardines in a can on the train, right? And you might be standing next to whether the dude's a white dude from Wall Street who's worth like $10 million, or, you know, the Chinese dude up the block, or the Russian dude around the corner, or the Jewish woman down the block, or at the deli. And you just, all of these different cultures, the Latinos, the Caribbean, you know, blacks, black people, like, we're all living in this sort of condensed space. So it forced you, or at least it forced me, to one, have an interest in other ways of life and other ways of thinking.
Right.
And especially through food, you know, like the first time I had Middle Eastern food, I was a little kid, you know, and I would sit in the stores with these guys, and, you know, they would have pictures of, you know, their brothers or their family, like right at the window. And, you know, you get talking to them. This is people you talk to every day, and they tell you stories about their life coming up that seem so far fetched. But with everything we've gone through as a not only a culture, a society now, it's like, you know, you just sort of gain a respect for other ways of living.
Yeah.
Like, there's space for us all. And the whole point is, and this goes back to Nubia, the biggest message I want the reader to take away is the idea of unity and what it really means. In actuality.
Yeah. You know, and I will say that your New York experience, even you as a native and me as a transplant, parallel each other very closely. So I totally relate to a lot of that. I also think about the fact that you are entering the YA market at a juncture in which we're also facing the whole like backlash against, you know, anything that even remotely resembles CRT. And I say that the way I say it because CRT is not taught in elementary schools or junior highs or, you know, what have you. But we're seeing, you know, more and more like book bannings and, you know, just people trying to deny the truths, the facts, the just, you know, honesty of other people's existences. And it's so interesting to me that that's how you framed that. Because I think to myself, what an interesting time to be entering that market when those very ideas, the idea of exalting what's different or saying how what's different is vilified is being attacked.
Yeah. And we've been through this before.
Yes.
Because I'm say this humbly, but I'm like low key historian.
I love it.
I'm a couch historian, but I only say that to say that when you study history, I'm talking about thousands of years. All they're doing is, you know, copying and pasting the same,
revising the story ideas. To fit. I mean, that's what they're doing. Yes,
revising is revisionist history. Yeah. I mean, even I don't want to go off on a tangent. We'll stick to Nubia, but I'm just to sort of put a button on this issue. Even when you look at, let's go back a few years ago and look at what ISIS was doing. They were destroying libraries. They were destroying structures that had stood for thousands of years. So in essence, they were trying to destroy history, actual history, mm-hmm. scrolls that had been around for thousands of years that people could go see and touch. And then in American culture, what we don't realize is when you go to a museum, all of that stuff was pilfered from other lands. Mm-hmm. This ain't ours. These are stolen goods that they put on display and then charge you to go see. So how that comes back to Nubia is, okay, well, I want to be in the future. What's it going to look like it's not about being morbid. It's about being realistic. Mm-hmm. So what if we don't change our way of living as human society? And all of these cataclysms, climate change, and all these things actually take place, then what does the world look like? You know, I think and on multiple layers. So like Nubia, the mythology of it is that Nubia was a utopian society. It was its own island nation off the coast of Africa. The men and women there lived in perfect harmony with the land, so much so that each individual was bestowed with a mystical power. And everyone was different. And
that was a good thing.
It was a great thing because everything was in total balance. They lived in total balance with their environment. Mm. There was no crime. There was no poverty. There was none of that. And, you know, along with climate change came war across the global war. And Nubia is destroyed. And so now the Nubians become refugees and they've all settled here in what New York would be in 100 years from now. You know, half of the city is basically underwater, mm-hmm. starting at the lower tip. And that's where all the poor people live, in the swamp. The rich, high and mighty, they live more towards uptown or midtown, which is what we're calling the up high. And not only are they have all the wealth and, you know, if you could picture a building three times as tall as the World Trade Center or something like that.
It's at Central Park South. Yeah.
Yeah. Right. But they've also fused technology into the body. Mm-hmm. So they live a completely different mm-hmm. existence. And so our main characters are Uzochi, who represents love, Lencho, who sort of represents hate, and Zuberi, who's sort of the gray area in between. Zuberi's our female. She's a warrior. Her father's a warrior. She just, you know, she stands on her square. She stands for truth and justice. Lencho is sort of our revolutionary. He's our revolutionary. He's about preserving the integrity of Nubian people. And Uzochi is the awkward teenager. He's just the awkward, you know, being a teenager is a very awkward stage of life because you think you know it all, but you know you don't know it all and you still have to live under other people's
rules.
You're
old enough to know
that
you need autonomy, but you don't necessarily know enough to have your own fully formed ideas. Absolutely.
Yeah. Right. And so the legend of the true Nubian history, because their parents had to scatter and, you know, live in this sort of, basically they were displaced. And they're just trying to get by. All of their parents' generations, they no longer have powers. They no longer have that magic. And they think it's been destroyed with their native land. And you have this sort of motley crew of teenagers, these Nubians, they're all around the same age, like adolescents. And it's like these mythical powers start to sprout in each of them, and they don't know what it is. So they're thinking they're like the weirdos, but they don't know, like, no, this is like real, because their parents never explained
this.
Right,
and this is your legacy as well. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So okay. It's kind of like dealing with stuff like that. You know, it's dealing with, like I just said, like displacement. It's dealing with socioeconomic issues. I brought up that word tribal on purpose because, you know, the people who are here prior to them coming, they think they're coming in to take over. So they have their own tribes, if you mm-hmm. will, and or the feeling of a gang to protect their turf, you know. And, you know, obviously those sides are going to clash. And obviously there's a lot of twists and turns and sort of shapeshifters, if you will, in terms of other characters who seem like they're down for one thing, but they really have an ulterior motive behind other things. And it's really fun. It's a really fun read. And I think that, you know, it's something you could really sink your teeth into, because there's just so many issues that correlate to now that I think about it in a way of like, it's like when we see some of this stuff on television that we've seen in the last couple of years, mm-hmm. it takes me back to being a kid. Well, we had a black and white TV until I was 16. So I remember watching like old footage of like the riots from like the 50s and the 60s and stuff. To watch something on screen is one thing. To see dogs being sick on people, human beings, little girls and boys, and they're sick and dog, and they have the fire hoses on them, and they're just beating them. You know, when I was watching that as a kid, I mean, who could wrap their mind around that? But I was so infuriated, but at the same time, I was motivated. So I say that to say, let's skip forward to now. You know, when you watch things like Ferguson and all these things, and you're like, it's so interesting how the universe has a mathematical equation for everything. So follow what I'm saying. Had we not been in a pandemic, in the lockdown, the George Floyd thing, it would have just been another thing that happened that locally they probably would have heard about. But the national uproar was only because everyone was stuck in a house and they had to be forced to watch. And this is how this parallels back to the past. You know who doesn't get enough credit for being a hero, like a shiro, is Emmett Till's mother, to have the courage all the way back then to say, no, show his face in the papers, because everybody that reads the paper is going to be forced to see what they did to my son. And it horrified people.
Yeah, I mean, people don't believe what they can't see. Stay tuned for more from the Writing Black podcast.
The Griot Star Stories with Teray, coming soon on the Griot's Black Podcast Network.
Welcome back to the Writing Black podcast. And I'm also, you know, really fascinated by when you fell in love with words. Because, you know, like most of us of my generation, our generation, you know, might have become familiar with you, I don't know, around 1992 with Juice. Mm-hmm. But I do, you know, my producer has surfed the internet. We found out that you were actually also a wordsmith prior to Juice, having been in the Wolf Pack. Can you tell me about like how words became another vehicle for you before, or maybe at the same time as acting? Because we all know you as an actor and you're a brilliant actor, but like, what else happened there?
Thank you. Well, I'll tell you, for me, I've just been inspired by the artists who inspired me. And I say that to say, for me, acting became an extension of writing. I mean, I've been writing poetry since I was like 8. You know, I've been reading Langston Hughes and James Baldwin and Maya Angelou and so forth and so on since I was like a little kid, you know, and I was just so, you know, I was just so captured by, you know, how certain artists, I call them, but we say individuals can express themselves through word. Even when you think about someone like Nina Simone, it's just how, like, you know, I would have these questions like, why is that being said that way? And then you have like the, then you get into the entendre world where it's like, you're saying one thing, but you're also saying this at the same time in this very same phrase. Mm-hmm. You know, I think as of now, Sean Jay-Z Carter is a master at that. You know, so things like that. And like I said, I always wrote poetry and then I got into rapping and everything like that. And I would read a lot. And you know, once I saw Sidney Poitier on television, I was like, I want to do that. You know, but understanding how to convey feelings and emotions and thoughts through word, through the format of acting became of interest to me. Because I actually, one of my secrets, I can say this now, but I actually always try to find a way to emote without saying something, you know, with, you know, and I'm very, very, I'm hands-on with my eyes with the audience. I always want them to see something else going on in this character, but this character is its own universe. We're all our own universes, you know. I don't know what you've gone through in your life, all of the minutiae of it, same for you to me, you know? So it's like that thing where, what's that feeling that we have when we know someone for some time and like, you feeling mm-hmm. right today? Mm-hmm. They're like, yeah, yeah, I'm cool. And you know, they're not. That's, to me, that's magic. Cause you know it, you feel it, though it might not be, it's not being said in dialogue at that time. So it's like, when you take something like that, and I was fortunate, and mind you, I did put in the work, study the craft. I still am studying the craft because I love it.
I love that you say that. You know, I was just fortunate to start off so early. It's an ongoing process, any craft, right? I love that you say that.
Yeah, exactly. And it's art. Art has no expiration date. That's mm-hmm. the beauty of it. It's not like it's athletics. Like one day your knee's going to give out and you can't jump so high. You can't run so fast. You know, some of the greatest artists delivered, you know, when someone's in their 70s or 80s, they had a whole different perspective of life at that point, you know? So it's to me, it's like an infinite medium. I mean, with what we can leave behind as artists, whether you're a painter, whether you're, you know, Alan Ailey, or, you know, whatever medium it is, we have the ability to transcend time through our art. And that's powerful to me.
I mean, it's powerful to me as well. And it's powerful to hear you say it. And I think also, you know, this through line of words, I love that. I love the way that you talked about, you know, moving from poetry into another medium, but it's all kind of the same thing. Because I agree with you as somebody who has worked in many mediums myself, that it always came back to storytelling and what the power of being able to do that. You mentioned you know, James Baldwin and Langston Hughes and like Maya Angelou, like who do you turn to, whether, and listen, it could be you're listening to them. So maybe it's Jay-Z, maybe it's, you know, who do you turn to when you're looking, when you think of someone who conveys messages in a way that like really resonates with you?
That's a long question. Yeah. That's a very, very big question. That's one of those I gotta have to ponder. No, but you know what? I'll go with Jay, you know. I'll go with Jay for now because of not only what he says and how he says it, but how he's living as a human being. You know, and how he is, we don't even know the power of how someone like that is inspiring the generations coming after on a multitude of levels, especially when it comes to being black and brown in the world, specifically in this country. You know, hip hop. Think about the jazz musicians. Mm-hmm. That was hip hop, you know, and then you go before that and you go before that and it comes right back to Africa, comes right back to the motherland. We have our tribes, we have our rituals. The girl is coming of age. The boy is coming of age. We do certain dances for a reason. We beat the drum for a reason. Everything is for a reason. We were the scientists. We were the ones doing the first surgeries. We were the ones who cultivated the land and learned how to sustain it and irrigate the land. We were the ones that's been stolen from us. So much to the point of where, if you follow me for a second, you know, you'll save up all this money. You'll either save the money or you go steal the money to buy a pair of $1,500 sneakers with some French name on it. Meanwhile, you got a dude over here who may be of your own, who's making the same quality of sneaker with a deeper meaning, but but that's that. That all comes from our history being stolen from us. And so we have to imbue the younger generation with the true worth of their value, of our value, of what we've contributed to this world, not just this country. We got to go past the narratives of, oh, we black, we built America. Yeah, no, we built the world. How about that? You know what I mean? And literally, let's study history. Let's study the facts. So we should be able to have these conversations. When I see the way that the world, the way that American society is right now, it can be off-putting. But as I said before, there's a gift within all of this for young people, because they ain't trying to go through what we're going through right now. That's not the way that they see the world. They see the world, they're experiencing the world in a completely different way. And so I think that we're at, I guess the right word would be an impasse, right? Of how we're going to move forward. And it's like, to me, let's think about technology. It's like the design of our society needs a firmware update, not a software update. What we're doing right now is software update. We need
a firmware
update.
So you're saying we should just turn it off and put it in some rice? Have...
No, I'm not saying turn it off and put it in some rice. I'm saying, you know, you could do a software update on your data plan.
Yes.
The firmware update, you got to be connected to Wi-Fi.
You want
to
jailbreak the whole thing. You just
want to
like...
I'm not saying jailbreak.
I'm trying to get the lingo.
I'm saying...
Okay, firmware update.
I'm saying... Firmware update. Okay. I'm using those words intentionally because it's, you know, here's the conundrum. Once you control a person's idea, you have them. You can control their perception of all things. The conundrum to that is you can't control anybody's idea. Period. Something similar may have been thought about before. Like they say, there's nothing new under the sun, but who thought of a phone with no buttons on it at a time where they were looking at Jobs like, what are you, crazy? But then you have to dig into that history. He patented that 20 years prior. Or you look at someone like George Lucas, for instance, the Star Wars. They developed technology. He had to wait to make certain films because they didn't have the technology to pull off his ideas. So, when I think about whether it's 10 years from now, 20 years from now, 30 years from now, obviously in Nubia, The Awakening, when I think about the book, what does it look like 100 years from now?
Right.
What can it look like? And what are the positives? You know, like they say, we got to go through the darkness before we get to the light. So ultimately at the end of not only this book, but just the story itself is there. It's bigger than there's a light at the end of the tunnel. The light is starting to emit from within.
I think you're right. I think it's out of necessity. And I think to your point, like there's an incredible opportunity there. And I am totally with you in terms of everything happens for a reason. And this era that we're in is happening for a reason. We know you from the screen saying other people's words, and we know you now on the page saying your words. Will we see you transitioning to screenwriting or bringing this narrative to the screen? Is that something that you have in mind, or are you just letting it breathe for now?
Absolutely. Yeah. No. Well, okay. From your lips to God's ears. I mean, that is the ultimate plan. And I have been quietly, writing and producing for at least the last decade,
just getting better and better.
It's a tough, but it's a tough business. Mm-hmm. I mean, as many incredible young Black and brown female filmmakers that I've been around that are producing amazing work, it was only one Black Panther. That's the problem, that Black Panther deserved everything and more, but there should be 100 more of them.
I do.
You see what I'm saying? So I hope to contribute to that, that resilience and stamina that an artist needs, because everybody's going to get their chance. This is what I tell young kids when I speak to them. Everybody's going to get a chance somehow, some way. The thing is to sustain is the hard part. You might get a chance to be in some movie, or you might get a chance to put out some song, or you might get a chance to write a book, and it's this big splash.
Right.
But then what? So we have to prepare for success in that way. We have to prepare for it, And you can see the difference between people who do and people who don't, And I think the younger generation just, I'm really excited for them, because I actually, my kids are 23, 18, and 14. And I think about, my 23-year-old is kind of the last of the Mohicans. Like, she remembers the world with no social media and stuff like that, And we had to go through that with her little sister, because she was like, why could she get a phone? I was 13. I wanted a phone. And it was like, but it was a different time. Like, now it's like, it's out of fear. Like, we need to, if something happens, we need to be able to get in touch with you, And, and I look at my son, he's a 14-year-old kid, and I try to imagine myself being 14, in the world now. It's like kind of scary to me. Because as I say, the time that I grew up in, things were just so honest. There weren't cameras everywhere. There was no people talk to people. If you were a young person interested in another young person, like for me being a male, if I'd seen a young female, you had to know how to approach her and have social interaction and talk with her and make her laugh. And, and these kids now, it's just, everything is this. It's the trippiest thing. They're like going inside a restaurant and everybody, four people at a table.
On their phones. I know. It's wild.
It's strange, but there's something to that where I always try to see. Well, I don't try. I try to see the silver lining, but I look at life through the lens of an artist. Like, every single thing to me is there's an art to it. There's something there to be that will enrich me. It's kind of how I look at the world. And they always say, like, the most valuable thing in this world is it's love. And it's, I'm like, yeah, love is very important, but time is the most valuable thing in the world. Because you can choose to fall out of love with somebody, or you could love somebody and don't even like them, But think about that. Like, when it comes to family, like, you love them because that's your family, but you don't want to hang out with them every day. You don't have a choice in time. Yeah. Like, this time that we're spending together right now, we'll never be able to get it back. And so I say that intentionally to say that's why when we say you need to make the best of our time, that's the truth. And we have every millisecond to do so. To grow, to evolve, to get better in the ways that we can. And a big part of that is, how are we treating one another? How are we affecting one another? How are we affecting one another? Every tribe has its place. Whatever you believe in, if you're a believer in a higher power, if you're not, certainly there's a vast thing in between that is sort of unexplainable, right? To a lot of people. And in, again, kind of bringing it back to Nubia, unpacking some of what that could look like, and sort of letting the reader define it by their own means. instead of trying to doctrinate them with what I think they should think, you know, it's sort of more posing questions. And again, I go back to the beginning of the conversation, like we spend time, not just as Black and Brown people, but I think just as human beings. I posted something this morning, and I think I'm going to give a counter post to it probably tomorrow. But I posted something about, you know, if a man has a good woman by his side who's pushing him to be his better self and so forth and so on, like honor and cherish her, because that's the best way for you to live in gratitude to the Almighty, whatever you believe in. But I want to counter that with the same thing for females. You know what I mean? And now we're in this sort of pronoun acronym world. Everyone is so sensitive, but at the end of the day, the sun is the sun and the moon is the moon and the clouds are the clouds and the sky is blue right now. Like, it is what it is. We can't be in that middle space of, you know, life is life. And that's why we have to embrace it. And kids, it's so cliche, but it's not cliche. It's just the truth. Kids are the future.
I hope not. Gosh, I hope not. No, I hope not. I think there are definitely points there. And I think that, you know, in terms of the fulfillment that we find, the fulfillment that we hope that a younger generation finds, I hope they find it both. I hope they find it first in themselves, but I hope they appreciate it when they find it in others, for sure. But I also, you talked about time, and I appreciate the time that you've given us, like, for this, you know, you've spoken so freely and so candidly, and I don't know that everybody does that. And I do really appreciate that, because I think we are obviously at a juncture where we're lacking that kind of candor and that kind of honesty, and where we're in need of a lot of vulnerability, I think, in terms of how we're approaching the world and how the world is approaching us. So, right. Omar Epps,
the world is going to be fine. The world is going to be fine.
You're right.
Look at what happened during the pandemic.
You're right.
What happened?
You are right.
The air cleared up. They saw animals coming out in places like, fuck, we could go out again. Finally, they're gone.
You're right. So you're right. The human species, we might have some things to work out, but you're right. The world is going to resolve itself. Right. Yeah, no, I just really appreciate you being here. And especially, you know, I think you and your presence, you have so much meaning to our audience and to generations, because I was just watching Raising Canaan yesterday, people. So right. Thank you so much, Omar Epps. And thank you for this book. Nubia of the Awakening will be out this fall. We are very excited. That's right. That's right.
Every book is sold,
and I will be digging into it soon, because I know y'all going to send me one. So thank you for explaining that to me.
And thank you
for celebrating Nubians, because, you know, we out here, as they say.
Yeah.
Thank you so much.
We out here. Thank you so much. I appreciate you guys so much. Thank you.
So if you're like me, Omar Epps represents one of your favorite times in your life. So it's a perfect time to talk about my favorites, which are books and readings and listenings and viewings that I like to recommend that relate to our discussions each week. And this week, I think Omar did such an incredible job of discussing Afrofuturism, and particularly how it relates to our past. And another author who is incredible at doing that is N.K. Jemisin. I highly recommend, you know, The City We Became is an excellent entree. One of my favorite descriptions is this one from a fellow author, Neil Gaiman. It's a glorious fantasy set in that most imaginary of cities, New York. And considering our discussion with Omar, I think that that's kind of a perfect companion piece for you to read, because having been a New Yorker myself, it is a little surreal. I'm like, you know, are we in the past? Are we in the future? Are we in the whatever? In Disneyland? We don't know. I also, honestly, and I say this because I've seen a lot of debates about this online, you know, over the past year or two. I am a huge Lovecraft Country fan. And I think, like, I got to a point where I was like, if you get it, you get it. And if you don't, you don't. And I understand that everybody wants to see some of the more abject horrors of our history. And some of us, you know, Just don't get it. And some of us just don't like it. And that's actually okay too. But if you are into understanding how Afrofuturism and actual African-American history fit together, I think, you know, get your little viewing party going on HBO Max with Lovecraft Country. And I think like Misha Green, just like she did with Underground, did an excellent job of kind of melding, dovetailing, comparing, paralleling, whatever word you want to use, these two eras, and letting us know that, as Omar said, you know, there's nothing new under the sun. Thank you so much for joining us for another episode of Writing Black. As always, you can find us on the Griot app or wherever you find your podcasts.
The Griot Black Podcast Network is here, and it's everything you've been waiting for. News, talk, entertainment, sports, and today's issues, all from the Black perspective. Ready for real talk and Black culture amplified? Be inspired. Listen to new and established voices now on the Griot Black Podcast Network. Listen today on the Griot mobile app and tune in everywhere great podcasts are heard.